Good morning, Boker Tov. Welcome to everybody, and a special welcome to some regular visitors that I've noticed from afar, from America, from England. More than welcome, and nice to see everybody. We are on part two. To continue, I'm going to reframe last week's discussion a little bit, and then move it on to a slightly different place, which I think you're going to find very, very interesting. A little bit controversial in places, but not so controversial. So we're not going to go too far down that road. Let's just reframe the debate as we saw it last week. Sources 1 and 2 on the sheet are repetitions of what we saw last week, but I thought there would be people here that weren't here last week, and I was right. So let's read them together and see how it goes. The question we raised from the Gemara in Shabbos is as follows. The Tani Rebbe Eliezer Omer, Ha'hoyri Kina B'Shabbos, Ka'hoyri Gamal B'Shabbos. If you kill a louse, we were talking about lice at the beginning of last week's shiur, if you kill a louse on Shabbat, it's as if, says Rebbe Eliezer, you killed a camel on Shabbat. Meaning, I don't care how small the creature is, creatures are creatures. You kill a camel, that's one of the 39 malachas. You kill a louse, although it's very tiny, it's also one of the 39 malachas. So the Gemara questions that, Matkiv la Rabbi Yosef. Rabbi Yosef says, no, that's not true. I cannot pligi rabbon alei ad Rabbi Eliezer, ela bikina, there is a machlaikas. And the Chachamim disagree with Rabbi Eliezer on the issue of bikina. De'eino para v'rava. It doesn't do pru ravu. This is all repetition from last week. A louse doesn't do pru ravu. It reproduces in a different way, we'll see in a minute. Aval sharshkotzim, but other creepy crawlies v'ramasim, de'parim v'ravim loy pligi. Then everybody agrees that if you kill flies and cockroaches or whatever it is, that is one of the Torah prohibitions on Shabbat. But if you kill a kina, if you kill a louse, there's a machloket. Rabbi Eliezer says it is a prohibition on Shabbat, and the Chachamim say it's not. What is the reason for the Chachamim? We saw last week, because the rabbi said the lice do not generate in a regular sexual way of pru ravu with males and females. Rather, they spontaneously generate. And we saw that spontaneous generation was a standard understanding of science in the ancient world up until the 17th, 18th century, when people realized that actually the things do not spontaneously generate, but rather they generate in a different way. Certainly can't miss that. I could do without phone in my house because I never hear the phone. So that's what I mean. Okay.
Sorry.
There's no problem at all. Spontaneous generation was something that was understood as obvious. You take a piece of meat, you leave it outside in the sun, it's completely clean, you can wash it, leave it outside for a couple of days, watch it. Nothing's happening, and it's crawling with maggots. All of a sudden, where did the maggots come from? Obviously, they spontaneously generated. They came out of nothing, and therefore, some things spontaneously generate. Of course, later on, the scientists realized that that's not true, and actually, there are microorganisms in the air, and you can't see them, and they are the ones that hatch and cause all of the life to form. Now, the question is, what are we going to do with this halakha? What are we going to do with this halakha? Are we going to maintain a belief, if you like, on the basis of the Gemara and spontaneous generation, or are we going to adapt the halakha and say, no, today you can no longer kill life on Shabbat? This is a practical halakhic question. Can you or can you not kill life on Shabbat? Says the Gemara, and ultimately Shulchan Aruch Paskins, yes, you can. Have a look at number two. Perushi talking about fleas. Asur l'tzad, you're not allowed to catch fleas. Ela in ken hu al basar ba oksor, unless they're about to bite you. Va'asur l'harga, but you're not allowed to kill fleas. Aval kina, says the Shulchan Aruch, mutar l'harga. You are allowed to kill life on Shabbat. Even though that might seem strange in Hilchos Shabbos, because they spontaneously generate, and the Shulchan Aruch maintains that in the 16th century, you're allowed to kill them. And that is the halacha as brought by the Mishnah Berurah. We saw last week the Mishnah Berurah in the 20th century also says you're still allowed to kill life on Shabbos. Why? Because the Gemara Paskin, you're allowed to, and therefore you're allowed to. Now, we saw last week three ways to approach this issue. One way was to say, well, maybe they're just talking about different life. And the life in the time of the Gemara Taka did spontaneously generate. And the lice that we have today don't spontaneously generate, so everybody's right. Chazal are right, the scientists are right. Can you kill lice on Shabbat? No, of course not, because they're different kind of lice. But we didn't change the halakha, we just realized that now there are different kinds of lice. That is one suggestion. And we said that's terribly difficult as a suggestion, even if you could posit that there were different kinds of lice, 2,000 years ago in Babel than there are today. It's hard to say that about 500 years ago in Europe, and it's very hard to say that about less than 100 years ago by the Mishnah Berurah. Yes?
But it wouldn't necessarily have to be that, because maybe the Mishnah Berurah didn't look at the life.
Well, okay, fine. If he didn't look at the life, why is he still saying we're allowed to kill them? Meaning, he says you're still allowed to kill them. He must obviously understand that if you're allowed to kill the life, what were we saying? Good, so we'll get to that. That's an answer for today, absolutely. We'll see that, of course, he didn't look at the question of science, but you could argue that there are different kinds of life, and actually we're not going to follow the Mishnah Berurah anymore. We are not going to kill the life because there are different kinds of life. That's a difficult answer because, for obvious reasons, it's very hard to suggest that the life species have changed in that way. You could argue, number two, we saw last week, Nishtane HaTeva. Nishtane HaTeva means maybe there's been some fundamental change in the nature of reality. And whereas, it's the same kind of life, but they've changed. They used to spontaneously generate, and now they no longer spontaneously generate. Now, Nishtane HaTeva is a real issue. We saw it last week. There are some areas we talked about in society, in life, where without any question, something has changed, and we gave 25 different examples of Nishtane HaTeva. Some of them were very obvious and seemed very true, and some of them were very far-fetched. And this one, it sounds like it should be a Yiddish word, far-fetched, but this one also seems a bit far-fetched to say that really the nature, the biology of life has changed to such a fundamental degree that we can say Nishtane HaTeva. So it's a difficult argument to run that something so fundamental has changed in that way. Again, Nishtane HaTeva is a real phenomenon. We do see in other areas that things have changed, but here, not so straightforward. Or we could say, the third approach last week is, science is just wrong. We're not interested. We're not even going to look at the science. And we saw Rabbi Yehuda Bril said last week, when this question was first raised, and we'll see who he was responding to in a minute, he said, I'm not interested in science. Even if all the winds of science blow, we have a stronger ruach than all of their ruchot. We have a ruach HaTorah. Torah is based on MS. They don't see things properly. They only see a surface level. We see much deeper. If Chazal say the science, the life spontaneously generates, they spontaneously generate. Okay? Now, again, we argue that maybe in the 17th century, that was a legitimate perspective on science. The question is whether we would say the same thing today. Are we going to disregard science in such a dismissive way today, or are we going to try and look for other approaches? And what I want to bring you today are five other approaches, which I think you'll find really fascinating. The first one blew up about 12, 13 years ago in the great Rabbi Slifkin debate. For any of you who remember that from 2004-05, you will remember that Rabbi Nosson Slifkin, who is an Englishman from Manchester originally, produced a number of very popular books about biology and science and Torah, and that's one of the issues that he's personally very, very interested in. He always was growing up, and now he runs the... Sorry, not happy. Can someone see if they can get the technician to deal with that? Yes, sorry, someone's on it. Okay, we had this last week, didn't we? Is it just my chair or does this happen to everybody? Okay, not that I'm insecure or anything.
It's science.
You don't believe in science. Anyway, Rabbi Slifkin produced a number of very popular books back in the day, where he brought a number of approaches, including the one we're about to see now, that got... No, we can't carry on with this. They might have to just turn it off. Well, I can't turn it off here. Apologies for this. Pull the plug.
That's like a very dramatic way. It's kind of...
I didn't do anything, but okay, fine. So one of the things that Rabbi Slifkin got into significant trouble over was bringing the approach that we're about to see now that I put as approach solution four. Maybe science is correct. And maybe Chazal were spiritual giants, yes. Baalei Masora, yes. But maybe they weren't scientists. And maybe they were just wrong on the science. And as you will probably remember, if you were following this debate, this blew up into a very, very serious controversy. And in the end, a book was written by Rabbi Moshe Meiselman, who became very much the Bar Plukta, the opposing figure on this particular issue. And Rabbi Moshe Meiselman's book is called Torah, Science, and Chazal. And he seeks to deconstruct each one of Rabbi Slipkin's points one by one and explain that. I am not going to get into all of the details on that now, but in the further reading at the back of the, just look for a second on page 6, I brought you in the further reading at the back, sources for how you can, or links for how you can get hold of all of these things. And I advise you, if this is an issue that interests you, get a hold of Rabbi Slipkin's books. You can see his stuff online. You can see Rabbi Meiselman's book. It's definitely worth reading through. You can see Rabbi Slipkin's 25 articles responding to Rabbi Meiselman's response to him. And it all became really quite personal on certain issues, which is a bit of a problem. But that's, again, I'm making no comment on that, but I advise you to read it and come to your own conclusions. I also brought you some other interesting books on that. The Great Partnership that we'll be quoting from soon by Rabbi Sacks. I strongly recommend that as a resource. It's an excellent book. And then various other books that I think you may have been aware of from some time ago. Two books by Nathan Eliezer, Gerald Schroeder's book, The Science of God, Rabbi Huda Levy's books on Torah and science, which are quite old now. And then for the real old-timers on these issues, but still the old stuff is often the best stuff, Cyril Dom and Harry Schimmel put together some material, must be 30 years ago now, the Challenge and Encounter material with Rabbi Aryeh Carmel, who we'll be quoting from as well. But even though that's old on the science, it's not old on the Torah, and I strongly recommend you to read all or any of that if you're interested. So let's have a look. What caused such a controversy when Rabbi Slipkin raised it? Have a look here in the Pachad Yitzchak in number 3. This is not Rav Hutner. This is Rav Yitzchak Lampronti, who is a lesser-known posik from the Italy in the 17th century. He says as follows, number 3, Ilav de Mistafina. Now, you know when someone says that, that something is about, some bomb is about to drop. Because Ilav de Mistafina means, if I weren't afraid to say this, and clearly he's not afraid to say this because he's about to say it, but Ilav de Mistafina, if I weren't afraid to say this, Amina, I would say to you the following. In our days where the scientists have looked and investigated and seen, the Yad'u v'kasu and have written, the kol bal chayyeh mishayyeh, I don't care what kind of animal it is, whatever it is, who mina beisim, I'm on source number 3 on the bottom of page 1, are all from eggs, they all come from reproduction. V'chol zeh hochichu b'ra'ayas brurus, they prove this with the clearest possible proofs. In case, therefore, if you want to be careful on Shabbos, so don't kill lice anymore. Stop killing lice. V'lo yarom, v'lo pirush, don't kill fleas, v'lo kina, don't kill lice. Why put yourself into a question of a Torah prohibition on Shabbos? The scientists have proved the lice the same what they used to be. U'v'davar azeh, amina, and on this I would further say, if the rabbis of the Chazal, if the rabbis of the Gemara had only been privy to the proofs that we have today in science, they would go back, they would change their minds, they would agree. Now that's a strong thing to say, that if Chazal were to see modern day science, they certainly wouldn't say what they used to say. As we'll see that example soon, he brings an example of something which Chazal did go back on what they previously said, based what it seems on, as it seems on scientific evidence. We're not trying to be makel, he says. I'm not trying to allow something on Shabbos. I'm trying to prohibit. So don't tell me that I'm being over lenient. I'm actually being strict in halacha. He may be being strict in halacha, but in hashkofa, is he being strict, or is he actually saying something quite fundamentally different? On this issue that we're about to see, this cosmological issue where the rabbis agreed to the non-Jewish scientists, it points very, very clearly with a finger. Not everything we read in the Gemara comes from Sinai. Not everything. Okay? Not everything comes from the Kabbalah. Not everything is a received a tradition. The Chachmei Israel dibru gam heim lefam mipi haseichu. The rabbis spoke sometimes from seichel, from their own understanding, the chakira, their own experimentation and empirical research, ha'enoshit, from human empiricism. So long as it's Kabbalah, not from Masorah. Because if that wasn't the case, why would they agree in this Gemara we're about to see Pesachim? Why would they go back and agree with the non-Jewish scientists? If it was a Kabbalah, they should have been mitchazek. They should have said, no way, we're going to reject anything but Kabbalah, I mean, their understanding of the Kabbalah. But Lord should mitzvah kol raya from Masorah. Why would they give way in front of any scientific proof if it was from Sinai? We saw last week, Rav Moshe Feinstein said, the Simani Trefus are Halakha L'Moshe Mitzinai. I don't care if the scientists tell us these animals can live for years and years. I don't even care if I see with my own eyes that these animals live for years and years. If Chazal say that these Simanim are Simani Trefus, zeh, that's it. There's nothing more to talk about it. That is the Halakha. According to Rav Yitzchak Lampronti, apparently not in every case do Chazal speak from Sinai. Yes.
The Gemara, the last couple of days in the Rosh Hashanah, for example,
yes,
talks about medical matters
from the knowledge of the past. We're going to see that now. There are other ways of understanding those medical Gemaras we'll mention as well, but let's have a look at the medical issues too. What is this Gemara that the Rav Yitzchak Lampronti is telling us that the Chazal changed their minds? Now look at the top of number 4. Chachmei Yisrael Omrim says the Gemara, the Jewish sages say, B'yom chama mahalechet lematam in a rakia. During the day, that's the easy bit. The sun goes under the heavens. We see it rising in the east, setting in the west. Where does the sun go at night? Question. Balaila, at night time, lematam in a rakia. It goes back over the same way. Say Chazal, apparently, it just goes through the heavens. Let's say the heavens are opaque, and it goes through, and it just goes back over the top, like behind the set, if you like. And it goes back over the top, and it comes back out again the next morning, and it comes underneath again. That's why you can't see the sun at night, because it's going over the top, behind the sky. But Chachmei Umas HaOlam Omrim, the rabbis of the non-Jewish world say, no, V'yom Chama Ma'alechet L'Matam Merekia. During the day, the sun goes underneath, as we can see it. U'Balayla L'Matam in Akarka. And at night, where does the sun go? It goes under the ground. That's why you can't see it. It's not going behind the sky. It's going under the ground and coming back up the other side. Now, this is not necessarily a conversation about whether the earth is flat or the earth is round. You could square this easily with the earth is flat as well. I'm not getting into all of that now, okay? And I'm not suggesting the earth is flat, don't worry. I'm just saying that this is a Gemara that doesn't necessarily deal with that issue. But there's an argument, where does the sun go at night? I'm a Rebbe, Rebbe Yehuda Anasi, who was the author, the editor, ultimately the Mishnah, he said, V'nirin divreihem midivreinu. They're right and we're wrong. I think I prefer their explanation to our explanation. Very interesting. Why do you say that? Presumably, if we take this at face value, which maybe we shouldn't, maybe there are deeper, more symbolic, mystical things going on under the surface here, that's possible, and that is one way that some of the Mephoshim have understood this. But if we take this at face value, it sounds as Rav Lampronti is saying, this is a scientific issue, we said one thing, they said something else, and ultimately we decided they were right and we just went back on our previous position. And this seems to be a position which is taken not just by the Pachad Yitzchak, but by many, many others in the Rishonim. Look, for example, in the Rambam in number 5. This is exactly your point. In the Mara Nevuchim, do not ask me, he says. I could read this in Hebrew, but it was originally in Arabic, so English is probably just as good. Do not ask me, he says, to reconcile everything that they, the sages, stated about astronomy with the actual reality. For the science of those days was deficient. And they did not speak out of tradition from the prophets regarding these matters, but rather as wise men in that generation on those issues, or from what they heard from the sages of that generation. It really very much what we just saw, that on certain issues, Chazal were giving us helpful advice of science and medicine, based on what? Based on the science and medicine of their time. So too, Rav Shri Ragon, possibly this was from Rav Haigon, it's from the Oite Gainim, he says in number 6, Rabbanan lav azvata inun. The rabbis were not necessarily doctors. Now, they were rabbis who were doctors, okay? But not necessarily they weren't all doctors. They told us things that they saw with their eyes on an illness-by-illness basis. The lav divrei mitzvah inon. They weren't giving us divrei mitzvah. It's the same idea. They weren't telling us that this comes from a masora, this comes from halacha in that way. Hilchach, therefore, says Rosh Hashanah, Lo tismachun an ilein asrata. Do not rely on the medical advice of the Gemara. I think this is pretty uniformly understood and universally accepted. Deleke da'avin minhon midam. Don't do any of it. Alabata demavdig v'yada bavadai machmas roisin bekir. Go to your local doctor and get your local doctor's advice, which of course for Ashuru was 9th century Babylonian medicine, which I wouldn't recommend you do that either today. But what he's saying is go to the local best doctor you can at the time, because the advice of the medical masters in Chazal is not relevant today. Now, there are other ways that you could understand that. And there are other Mephoshim that speak differently. There are people that say, well, we don't follow Chazal's medical advice because Nishkane Hateva, like we saw last week. It used to work, and it was right, but it doesn't work anymore because we've changed. Okay? There are others that say, of course it used to work, of course it's correct, but we don't really understand exactly what they were saying. Maybe we'll get the wrong grasses or herbs, and maybe we'll get the wrong dosage, and therefore don't try it because you'll get it wrong. But not because it is wrong. Here he's saying, no, don't try it because it's wrong. And okay, we're not bothered that it's wrong. It's not a problem for us that it's wrong. Look here in the Ein Yaakov. This is translated from a very important essay, which I've given you a link to, by Rav Aryeh Carmel, called Freedom to Interpret, which is available online. You can get that as a PDF, and it's well worth a read. He says here, number 7, the great excellence of the sages, this is from the Ein Yaakov Mamala Droshes, the great excellence of the sages, the Talmud, in the interpretation of the Torah, and the investigation of all its rules and details, does not oblige us to accept all their statements in the spheres of medicine, natural science, or astronomy. Nor need we believe them in these matters as we believe them in the interpretation of the Torah, since its deepest wisdom is theirs, and it is their task to teach it to all. The Torah is the deepest wisdom of Chazal, but not necessarily science. And Rav Hirsch says this very explicitly. Number 8, in my opinion, the first principle that every student of Chazal's statements must keep before his eyes is the following. Wow, the first principle. What's the first thing you have to realize? Chazal were the sages of God's law, the receivers, transmitters, and teachers of his Torah, his mitzvahs, and his interpersonal laws. They did not especially master the natural sciences, geometry, astronomy, or medicine, except insofar as they needed them for knowing, observing, and fulfilling the Torah. We do not find that this knowledge was transmitted to them from Sinai. We find that Chazal themselves considered the wisdom of the Gentile scholars equal to their own in the natural sciences. To determine who was right in areas where the Gentile sages disagreed with their own knowledge, they did not rely on tradition, but on reason. Moreover, they even respected the opinion of the Gentile scholars, admitting when the opinion of the latter seemed more correct than their own. I think it's clear that this is an approach which many people have taken over the centuries. It may not be the mainstream approach, and it is controversial, as Rabbi Sliskin found out. Meaning people said to Rabbi Sliskin, you can't say this about Chazal. And he said, well, I'm not saying it, I'm just quoting what they say. To which the response was, well, in some case, maybe people felt he was misquoting it. Okay, that's an interesting discussion that needs to be looked at carefully with the back and forth on the book. Or, perhaps more fundamentally, some people came back at him and said, yes, they said it, but we can't say it now. We can't say that now. That's not acceptable now. To which he asked, well, why not? Where do we ever find that we've kind of censored opinions out of the Rishonim? And the response is, because there's a psak in Hashkafa, like there's a psak in Halakha. And that is a very important modern Hashkafic, meta-Hashkafic debate. How does Hashkafa work? Indeed, there is a psak in Halakha. In Halakha, there is a halachic system. If I find some interesting and slightly sort of fringe position of the Rishonim on Hilchos Shabbos or Hilchos Kashrus, I can't say, well, you know, the remark quotes that actually Rabbeinu Tam says that between milk and meat, okay, how long do you need to wait between milk and meat, between meat and milk rather? He says, well, it says in the Gemara to wait from one meal to the next. So what was the opinion of many of the Rishonim Ashkenaz? So they said, fine, so if it's the same meal, we won't eat meat and milk together, but as soon as the meal's finished, we'll bench, we'll wash our hands, we'll clean out our mouth, and then we'll have cheesecake immediately. 10 minutes later. More than the Dutch. The Dutch wait an hour. The Dutch waits an hour because of the Zohar, because the Ashkenazim. So can I turn around and say, well, come on, you know, if it's good enough for Ravain and Tam, then it's good enough for me. Oh, I'm frummer than Ravain and Tam. I'll also wait 10 minutes, wash my mouth, bench, wash my hands, and eat cheesecake immediately after a mean meal. No, you can't do that. That is completely asur, because there's a psak in halakha. The halakhic system moves in a certain direction. The Shulchan Aruch rejected that opinion, and you can't follow it. But is that true of Hashkafa? Even if the mainstream opinion is that Chazal were not wrong on medication issues or medical issues, if there is an opinion that says they were, can I say, well, that speaks to me more or not? This fundamentally is a machlokes between different worlds within the Jewish people today. And Rabbi Slifkin, if you like, brought this out to the fore by this debate, and we see that in certain sectors of Orthodoxy today, they do feel that there's a psak in Hashkafah, and you cannot say even what the Rambam said, because that is now unacceptable. So that's a broader issue which we need to talk about more, but not all today. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach had an interesting insight on this. Look over the page of page 3. This is a much less well-known source. Top of page 3. There is a sefer out there called Sefer Shmirat Haguf V'Hanefesh. It's a very interesting three-volume sefer. And he goes through all of the sort of weird and wonderful things that Chazal have to say about what is dangerous and what is not dangerous and whether we still follow them or don't follow them. In the introduction to that sefer, he brings the following debate. Look at number 9. Ba'alom ra'iti b'sefer Nishmat Abraham. He quotes the Sefer Nishmat Avraham by Rabbi Abraham Abram, a very, very well-known medical scholar, Talmud Chacham. Perik Yudalev, Seif Dalev, he says, Shemevi Divrei Rav Shriragon. He brings Rav Shriragon that we just saw. And Rav Avram bin Arambam, who also says this, who we didn't see. Umana Inyan Zeh Ke'echad Min Atamim. And he brings this approach, the approach that Chazal were not medically qualified in today's terms. He brings this as one of the reasons She'ein Lishtamish Rufuah Talmud was the Talmud, that we don't follow the medical advice of the Talmud. One of the reasons. The Hagona Shlomo Zalman Auerbach Shlita He'ir al zeh. Rav Auerbach makes a comment in the Nishmat Avram, and he says, the Nachon Hayah Lahavish Shita Zo B'Shem Yesh Omrim, that he would prefer if this approach was quoted not as just another approach, but as a Yesh Omrim. What does Yesh Omrim mean? It's a minority opinion. The ha'ika, but the main opinion, who, kasharatamim, the other reasons, nishtane hateva, or we don't really know what they were saying, or they were speaking much more deeply. So the author of this sefer wouldn't let that rest. Why did Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach insist that this was presented as a yesh omrim? The sha'alti la'agon Rav Shlomo Zalman shlita, mi hu zeh shechonik al divrei Rav Shriragon, for Rav Avraham bin Arambam. Who exactly disagrees with this in the classical sources? Meaning, people disagree with this today, for sure. You'll get your books banned quite quickly in certain circles if you quote this. But who disagreed with this then? And look at what Rav Shlomo Zalman says. V'kasav li v'zeh lashono. And he wrote back to me, Ke'eit einein zocher im yesh mishu shem mamash cholek. I'm not quite sure, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, if there's anyone who really disagrees with this. I'm not even sure that you can disagree with it. I think it's going to be from now. Ah, here we are. Say, I'm not even sure if you can disagree with it, says Rav Shlomo Zalman. Since many people give the other reasons, I have to get this fixed by next week, I'm going to hold it. Since many people give the other reasons, he says, don't worry, I'm not going to sing you a song, it's really fine, okay? But lo yizkiru klal mifnei shipur hayeda, and they don't talk about the idea that maybe we've improved in our knowledge, but darche refuah bizmanenu, l'chein heiruti sheroi lichtov b'shem yesh omrim. That's why I wanted you to write it as a yesh omrim. U'b'prashe v'inyani shabbos yesh matir melecha shabbos avshel edat ha'roifim ein shum sakana. It's a slightly different thing. So Rav Shlomo Zalman is sort of hedging a little bit, and he put him on the spot and said, do we really disagree with this approach, even though it's controversial? And Rav Shlomo Zalman says, No, I'm not sure we do, but put it in the Yeh genre. It's probably safer that way, and you'll get everything through nicely. It's an interesting approach, this approach, and this has died down. I don't think people are quite as interested in this as they were 5 years ago, but I did want to bring it to your attention, because this is definitely something which is discussed, and I advise you, read Rabbi Meiselman's book, look at his responses, look at Rabbi Slivkin's counter-responses, and come to your own conclusions. Fine. And that's the end of that solution. Yes, sir?
I just wanted to add that some business about the sun going around the earth, well, back over the heavens,
yes,
actually has a logic implication, since they task is like they're going. Today, we don't draw water for the matzah at night
because it heats up underneath.
So you see, they actually...
Right.
Actually accepted.
Yes, the issue of mine shalamu, mine water which has been overnight and cooled down, the question is, can you take it from the ground or does it heat up because the sun goes underneath? And that of course assumes that the earth is flat, not round, whatever, that's not for now. Solution number 5. A totally different approach. Let's take a step back and ask ourselves, maybe we're just approaching this all wrong. Why are we trying to make halacha and science kind of fit together? Maybe they're just two different ways of looking at things completely, and we shouldn't be trying to do this. And I want to bring you a number of really interesting quotes, most of them in English, and I apologize for that, but most of them were written in English. Some of them were, some of them weren't. And you'll see what's going on here. Here from Michtam Eliyahu, which I brought you in the Rabbi Carmel's translation in number 10. I have seen fit to note here, this is Rav Dessler, that which I heard explicitly from Rav Dessler, when he was asked about certain laws for which the reasons that have been given for them are inconsistent with the reality determined by scientists of later generations. It is ruled that one may kill a louse on Shabbos, because the louse doesn't reproduce sexually but spontaneously generates. And Rav Dessler said that with these and similar cases, the law is never changed. Rav Dessler said, you kill those lice, don't worry about it. Even though the reason is not initially understandable to us, rather, we must firmly grasp the law with both hands, whether for stringent or for lenient ramifications. The reason for this, explained Rav Dessler, is that Chazal knew the law as a tradition from earlier generations. But with regard to the scientific explanations, it is not the explanation that mandates the law, but rather the opposite. The law mandates an explanation. He wants to say that halacha is independent of the science. Chazal had a Masorah that we're allowed to kill a louse on Shabbos. They had that, as there is a Masorah going back as far as it needs to go back. And therefore that's the halacha. They were then searching, well, why? Why would there be such a halacha as a tradition that you're allowed to kill a louse on Shabbos? Oh, it must be because lice spontaneously generate, and therefore they gave that as the reason. The reason given in the Talmud is not the sole possible reason. And if on occasion they gave an explanation that according to the scientific knowledge of their day, we are obliged to search for other explanations which establish the law on the basis according to the scientific knowledge of our day. Thus I heard from Rav Dessler. So Rav Carmel then suggests, according to this principle, we can perhaps say, for example, as follows. It is a known principle that the halacha only considers that which can be detected by the senses. According to this, perhaps, we can say that since the egg of a louse is extremely small, so much so that at the time of the giving of the Torah it could not be detected at all, the halacha does not consider it at all, and the louse is rated as if it was born from material which it grows in and consumes, and thus it rates as a lower degree of life form, for which there is no prohibition of taking a life. We can explain similarly for insects that grow in fruit, and there are certain insects that grow in fruit, that started in the fruit, that you're allowed to eat. The egg that the parent lays in the fruit from which the insect hatches cannot be seen at all, and is considered as if it does not exist. Therefore, these insects are considered by the halacha as though they were born from the fruit itself in which they grew, and they are permitted to eat. All such matters can be explained in similar ways, and if we do not find an appropriate reason, we shall believe with perfect faithfulness that the law is a true law, and we shall look to Hashem to illuminate our eyes to find a fitting explanation. He says, the halacha is the halacha. And if you don't like that reason, find another reason. He suggests a reason. Maybe lice are too small, and therefore they're halachically irrelevant. That's why you can kill them on Shabbos. Okay? If you don't like that reason, find another reason. But either way, the halacha remains the halacha, because the halacha and the science have nothing directly to do with each other. I brought you this piece from Rav Soloveitchik, and we're going to see soon some other approaches from Rav Soloveitchik too. This is his extract to the Rabbinical Council of America. And have a look at what he talks about here. The Rav speaks of the two peaks, the two worlds of Torah and Western culture. Actually, this is not from, I don't think, his address to the rabbinical council. I'm not sure. I need to check that. And the need for the individual to live on both of these peaks, in both of these worlds, and move back and forth between the two. The Rav adds that though on the one hand there is an abyss separating these two peaks, and that no one, not even the Rambam, succeeded in building a complete and fully adequate bridge between them, on the other hand, the peaks must be brought into contact, into relationship with another. They must understand one another. Meaning, they don't have to agree with one another. They are two different peaks. There's Torah and there's science. They just have to have a connection between them. We want the man who studies Gemara, this is from Rav Soloveitchik, to understand the other peak. The entire physical mathematical world and the philosophical interpretation of the world differently than the dry mathematical physicist who dwells entirely in the realm of the profane, in the secular workaday world. We also want to bring that experience, that understanding of the depth and exactitude that we acquire while we're on the other peak, the peak of culture, into the peak of holiness of Judaism in order to deepen it and broaden it and gain new insights from it. We must bring the beauty of Yefet into the tents of Shem. He's saying that there are two different procedures here. There's halacha, Shem, and there's science, culture, philosophy, Yefet. They're two different things. They don't have to agree with each other. What we need to find, and this is obviously classic synthesis Torah, if you like, is we have to find a way of linking the two so that the scientific culture, if you like, and exactitude and discipline can be brought into Torah and enhance Torah, and the Torah, morality and ethics can be taken to science and enhance science. But don't think you have to make them agree, because they don't need to agree. They're two completely different things. And indeed, Rav Soloveitchik says in The Lonely Man of Faith, looking number 12, I have not been perplexed by the impossibility of fitting the mystery of revelation into the framework of historical empiricism. He's alluding here to the question is, well, what do we do with the fact that most of the scientific, historical, archaeological, academics that deal with antiquity do not agree with the historicity of the Torah? Are we bothered by that? I'm not debating whether it does or it doesn't. The received wisdom within the academic world for most academics is that they do not agree with the historical timeline of the Torah. There are those who do. There are those who do. And there's definitely disagreement within the academic world on certain issues. But it would be incorrect to say that the academic world fully agrees with the account of the historical timeline of the Torah. What do we do with that? Now, there are ways to deal with that, and this is not a shir on that, and we may turn around and give various different responses as to whether we accept the academic literature, we disagree with it, how we disagree with it, we care about it, we don't care about it. That's not for now. But Rav Soloveitchik says, it doesn't bother me. Moreover, I have not even been troubled by the theories of biblical criticism, which contradict the very foundations upon which the sanctity and integrity of the scriptures rest. While it is true that in earlier generations the rabbinic scholars did feel it necessary to defend Judaism against attacks from Christianity, science, and academic scholars, this is not typical of contemporary orthodoxy. He says you don't need to get upset about this anymore. You don't need to have to feel the need to defend Torah against science, because they're two different things. And there are other ways of dealing with it. And Rav Sacks picks this up in two very beautiful quotes from The Great Partnership, which I recommended to you. He says in number 13, in a way that only Rabbi Sacks can. Science, I won't imitate his accent, it's fine. Science, although I am tempted. Science is about explanation. Religion is about meaning. Science analyzes. Religion integrates. Science brings things down to their component parts. Religion binds people together in relationships of trust. Science tells us what is. Religion tells us what ought to be. Science describes. Religion beckons, summons, calls. Science sees objects. Religion speaks to us as subjects. Science practices detachment. Religion is the art of attachment. Self to self. Soul to soul. Science seeks the underlying order of the physical world. Religion hears the music behind the noise. Science is the conquest of ignorance. Religion is the redemption of solitude. Don't you wish you could write like that? And so he says in number 14, if science is about the world that is, and religion is about the world that ought to be, then religion needs science, because we cannot apply God's will to the world if we do not understand the world. If we try to, the result will be magic or misplaced supernaturalism. We will rely on miracles, and the rabbis ruled, don't rely on miracles. So we need science to understand the world. By the same token, science needs religion, or at the very least, some philosophical understanding of the human condition and our place within the universe, for each fresh item of knowledge and each new accession of power raises the question of how it should be used. And for that we need another way of thinking. They are two systems. That's why he calls the book the Great Partnership. Science and Torah don't have to conflict or be made to not conflict, because they do two different things. This is not new. Rav Hirsch said 150 years ago, number 15, Jewish scholarship has never regarded the Bible as a textbook of physical or even abstract doctrines. In its view, the main emphasis of the Bible is always on the ethical and social structure and development of life on earth. That is, on the observance of laws through which the momentous events of our nation's history are converted from abstract truths into concrete convictions. This is why Jewish scholarship regards the Bible as speaking consistently in human language. The Bible does not describe things in terms of objective truths, known only to God, but in terms of human understandings, which, after all, is the basis for human language and expression. The Rav Hirsch says the Torah is not a history book. The Torah is not a science book. Yes, of course there are historical events in the Torah. Yes, of course there are. But it's not meant to be teaching history. Don't try to read it in the way you'd read a history book. Don't try to read Maaseh Bereishis in the way you'd read a science book. You're reading the Torah wrong. Yes?
There was a question
that came
up. I
Interesting. So we'll see a very interesting example of that in a more, even more concrete way, number 19. Maybe we can, if it's a halachic matter, let's flip over to the last page five. If we have time, we'll come back to Rav Soloveitchik. If it's a halachic matter, maybe what we need to be doing is halachic research and not worrying about science. Have a look in number 19 for a second. Says the Tzitz Eliezer. The Tzitz Eliezer, as is well known, Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, lived just opposite Shaare Tzedek when it was in its old building, Shaare Tzedek, before. He used to give shiurim to the doctors there, and he became, even though he wasn't officially the rabbi of the hospital, he became a very well-known posek in medical issues, and was consulted by Rav Avraham Steinberg and others when they were junior doctors there, very consistently on such issues. He deals in 1977 with DNA and blood testing for paternity. Can you use a blood test to prove whether somebody is not the father of a child? And this is a halachic issue for many, many questions. There could be many halachic things that turn on whether indeed there is a blood relationship between this, in terms of who they can marry, in terms of inheritance, kibbutz, in many things. Okay, number 19. I'm going to come to your second question, he says. This is the Lezel Hashon She'elato Hashnia. This is the language of the second question. Yadua, it is well known. She'al yidei bidikot suk hadam. By checking blood type. Now obviously, since 1977, we've moved on in different ways to check DNA, etc. But this was a blood test. Efshel yishlom bevadaot. You can negate with certainty. Sheruvin hu ha'aba shel yelet. That Reuben is the father of a child. Afpan Iyeshel Vadasha who came Ha'aba, you can't with 100% certainty say that he is the father of the child. Rakshi Yitachen Shehu Ha'aba. You can only give a probability that he may be the father, but there comes a point with a blood test that you can negate the possibility that he is, and you say he's definitely not. Ha'im Bedika V'Tosotea. Can this test and its outcome Tofet V'Makom B'Dinei Torah? Can this take the place of Edim? Can this be a good aid or a siman of some kind that will have halachic consequence? Look at what he answers. Surprising answer. Vashivan kulakaman. And I want to answer the following, says Waldenberg. The Mesechet Nida. It says in Mesechet Nida. Tan Rabbana. Shlosha Shutfim Yesh Ba'adam. There are three partners that create a human being. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Va'aviv Ve'imoy. Aviv Mazriya Haloiven. And the Gemara now has an interesting analysis. The father gives all the white material. Shemimenu atzamot, that come from that is the bones, gidim, the sinews, tiparnaim, the nails, moach, sheba rosha, the brain matter, the loivin, sheba ayin, and the whites of the eyes. Imai mazrav odin, and the mother gives the red. Shemimenu, from that is or, basar, sarod, the skin, and the flesh, and the hair, the shachor sheba ayin, and the pupils of the eye. And Hashem gives the neshama. So everybody contributes. The white material, quote unquote, from the father, the red material, quote unquote, from the mother, and the neshama from Hashem. V'hine, says Rav Aldenberg, ba'odim sheba isha mazrad, barur shekalul bazer, ulai od berosh v'rishona adam. It's clear that the most red thing that is in the body is the blood. And indeed he says, ubahagod hagro, and the Gra actually corrects the Gemara, magia behedi b'gemara v'gam, and he includes the word, the blood, as something that you get from the mother. The king comes to behead you, gamba she'iltas, and this is also in the she'iltas, which is a earlier shown him. The inkein, the kevin shehadam bamin ha'isha, since therefore the blood comes from the woman, from the mother, zihut dam, the identity of the blood, yacholi yod likvoa ben le'imo, you can establish maternity, the mother's relationship with the blood, avalo ben la'avit, but not paternity. Because the blood doesn't come from the father. So I'm not prepared to accept the blood test to negate the possibility that this man is the father of the child, because blood is not relevant to paternity. Now, there's not very much scientific about this, but he's not interested in the science of it. Because he's saying halacha is halacha, and it comes from a different place. It's independent of the science. It exists in its own independent form, and therefore the halachic answer may have nothing to do with the scientific answer at all. Maybe just go back, because I think this is a good place to see Rav Soloveitchik. Look at what Rav Soloveitchik said in number 16. This very famously is from an address he gave to the RCA back in the 70s. Says Rav Soloveitchik, he's here dealing with the issue of hafka'at kiddushin, which we talked about some time ago, is can you turn around and say that a woman, if she marries a man and he turns into something fundamentally different from what you thought he would be, can you turn around and say that the wedding is a mekach ta'ut, the whole wedding is a mistake? We talked about this when we talked about the aguna issue about a year and a half ago, meaning if it's clearly a completely different man, she intends to marry a man and it turns out his identical twin brother standing under the chuppah, and she only discovers 2 days later, so obviously she doesn't need a get for that. There's no marriage. She married someone she doesn't even know she's marrying. But let's say she marries a man and assumes that he's a nice fellow, and it turns out that he's an awful fellow. Now, of course, she's entitled to a get, and maybe she's entitled to a ksuba, depending on the case, but is she entitled to dissolve, to annul the marriage on the basis, not a marriage, mekatot? It's not what I expected. No, you can't do that. Why? Because the Gemara says a phrase which the Rav Soloveitchik is going to defend here. Number 16. This has absolutely nothing to do with the social and political status of the woman in antiquity. The chazaka he's going to quote now is Tav lemeitiv tandu melemeitiv armanu. That a woman would always prefer to be married than to prefer to be single. And therefore, you cannot assume that she would not have wanted to make this marriage a real marriage. It needs to be divorced, yes. There needs to be a solution to end the marriage. But you can't say there was never a marriage. This chazaka is not based on sociological factors, but on a verse in Bereishis. And your desire shall be to your husband. It is not a psychological fact. It is an existential fact. Meaning, don't start giving the arguments that the social position of women in antiquity was different, and yes, then they would have preferred to be married because they had no support structure, no independent income, but today it's different. No, nothing to do with sociology. To say that Tav lemeitiv tandu melemeitiv armanu was due to the inferior political or social status of women at that time is simply misunderstanding the chazakot. Not only the halachot, but also the chazakot of our sages introduced are indestructible. You must not tamper not only with the halachas, but even with the chazakas. For the chazakas spoke not upon transient psychological behavioral patterns, but on permanent ontological principles rooted in the very depths of the metaphysical human personality, which is as changeless as the heavens above. Halacha is halacha. Science, sociology, psychology is something else. And therefore you cannot mix the two. Two peaks. You can connect between them and learn from one, but you cannot seek to kind of merge them in that sense that will confuse the status, the independent status of the halacha. In number 17, this is a very classically Rav Soloveitchik line. Objectification reaches its highest expression in halacha. Halacha is totally objective. Halacha is the act of seizing the subjective flow and converting into enduring and tangible magnitudes. It is the crystallization of the fleeting individual experience into fixed principles and universal norms. In short, halacha is the objectifying instrument of our religious consciousness, the form principle of the transcendental act, the matrix in which the amorphous religious hilo is cast. Now you know why more people buy Rav Sachs' book than Rav Soloveitchik's book, because they're harder work. But he's basically saying that don't think that halacha is some kind of shifting sand, that as time goes on, we change the principles. No, it is based on a metaphysical reality, which is ultimately Kabbalistic, which is number 18, Kutcha Brichu Istatil Be'oraisu Bara Alma. God looks into the Torah to create the world. Baranash, now a human being, Mistaka Babaraisa, looks back into the Torah, Umakayim Alma, and runs the world and upholds the world. This idea that the Torah precedes the world, I'm not talking about the Torah in terms of the ink on the cloth, but the idea, the mystical Torah, the Torah of God's mind, okay, that precedes the world. This is a very mystical idea, and this brisker Torah of Rav Soloveitchik in that sense is based in that mystical idea. So that's the solution. Halacha, science, just don't worry about it. It's fine. Two different things, and we can certainly keep on killing our lives on Shabbos. Let's look at two or three final quick approaches. Number B3, solution 6, is very interesting. The Chazon Ish goes down this route. It's well known that there is a position in Chazal that the world is divided, history is divided into three sections of 2,000 years. 2,000 years of Tohu Vavohu, which is from creation until Avraham Avinu. 2,000 years of Torah, and 2,000 years in which Mashiach could come. And when we gave a shir on Mashiach, Baruch Hashem, we've covered many things over the last 77 shirim on this issue, we talked about whether we actually take this as being axiomatic, that Mashiach has to come by the year 6,000, or doesn't have to come by the year 6,000, and we can talk more about that another time. What year it actually is not entirely clear. We think it's 5778, it might be more something like 594 something. That all depends on what you did with the missing 164 years. That's a completely different shir, which is not for today. But let's take the 2,000 years of Torah as being from Avraham Avinu until the beginning of the Gemara. Says the Chazon Ish in number 20, it appears that Hashem creates cures, even for trephus. He's dealing with the fact that Chazal said that these animals cannot live for more than a year, and therefore they are trephus, even though today they do live for many years. But these were not revealed in every generation and in every place. And there were those that were revealed and then forgotten. Everything was arranged and set by the Creator at the beginning of creation, and it was given over to the sages to establish the trephus according to the Holy Spirit that was displayed upon them. The establishment of trephus was according to divine providence at the time. And those diseases which were fatal at that time, for which the Holy One did not give a cure to his creations at that time, are the trephus which are forbidden by the Torah, whether at that time or in future generations. He says there's a download, there's a window, there's a download window of 2,000 years. That's called the 2,000 years of Torah. Whatever science is understood during those 2,000 years of download window, that's what determines halacha. If you discover new science after that, good. But it's irrelevant, because the window is closed, we're offline, there's no more Torah coming down, and therefore it's not relevant the fact that the animals live longer now. Yes?
And how is it that Rob will ask a doctor for the latest medical information?
No, because that's to establish the metzius, not to establish the halacha. Meaning, he's not asking the doctor for medical information so he can work out what the halacha is. Or the halachic, if you like, in principle what the halacha is. The psak. The psak is independent of the science. The psika depends on the science. Meaning, when you're actually trying to apply that psak to a modern day real scenario, you need to know what exactly is the information in terms of metziyud, in the reality that I'm dealing with here. That's what he needs to know from the doctor. How sick is this person? How long can they live? What is their prognosis, etc.? He's not asking the doctor to help him work out how to understand the sugya in the Gemara, as to what the psak in principle would be. Yeah, there's two. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has a wonderful essay on psak and psika and how they go together. That one is a process that happens in the Bet Midrash, and the other is a process that happens in consultation with doctors and lawyers and people of that nature. The last two approaches are very important, and they're quite fun, but they won't take us as long, which is good because we only have 5 minutes. We mustn't forget that whenever we read Chazal, we are reading something which is much deeper than what we initially think. And the Rambam stresses this again and again and again. Look in the Rambam in the Perush HaMishnah 21. The Fisha Divrei Kol Balei Chochma, the Dvarim HaNisgavim. Whenever wise people speak about elevated matters, Shehem HaTachlis, which are the ultimate realities, Einam Elevater Chidur Mashal, they don't say it, it's not like the New York Times writing prose. They don't speak in that language, they're speaking in much more, in much deeper, maybe even sometimes poetic ways. Umadua nitpale al shechibru et hachochma b'derech moshel. Why are you surprised that they write this way? Why are you comparing the writings of deep wisdom to the writings of shveilim hamoinim, of my example, the New York Times? That everyday common prose where you don't expect there's anything deeper. What you see is what you get. That's when you read the newspaper. That's not when you read Chazal. Or, by the way, the Rambam will say, Lahavdil, when you read Aristotle either. When you read deep wisdom, you have to look deeply. And therefore, we must never fall into the trap of reading anything in Chazal and assuming, oh, well, that's what they said. That must be what they meant. Very simple. We don't agree. That's not the case. We have to always analyze. And this is even more so in the Torah itself. Reading the Torah itself, there are many, many, almost infinite perhaps, levels of depth which we have to realize, and therefore that's a health warning which I think is very important. The last approach I brought here, and I brought this rather attractive picture of a mouse with an ear on its back. This ear, by the way, is not a real ear. This ear is an ear-shaped cartilage which has been grafted onto a mouse by seeding it with cow cells. Okay? So it's a mouse with something that looks like a human ear made from cow cells. So it is still a bit of a tolerance, it's true. Why did I bring you this? Because the Mishnah speaks in very interesting terms about animals which are part this and part that. Number 22. Achbar. What about a mouse, says the Mishnah? Shechetzav basar v'chetzav adama. Which is part organic and part adama, part dust. A partly organic and partly inorganic creature. Hanogea bebasar tame. If it's a dead reptile, which bit of it makes you tame as a sheriff? If you touch the basar bit tame, but adama, if you touch the non basar bit tahor. Rav Yehuda Amar Afanogea ba'adama shekineged basar tame. They're having a whole discussion about a mouse which is made partly of organic matter and partly of inorganic matter. If you touch this bit, if you touch that bit, etc. Like, is there such a mouse? I don't know. Could there be such a mouse? I'm not putting any money on that. Meaning Chazal speak to scenarios which may to us sometimes seem, well, that can't be. Well, never say never. There's lots of things 100 years ago that people thought could never be. You know, there was a wonderful book written in 1990 about what will things look like in 2000. And it predicts everything that would be just 10 years later. The one word that doesn't appear anywhere in that book is the word internet. The one thing that revolutionized society probably more than anything in the last 600 years wasn't even foreseen in any way 10 years before, as a prospect. And of course, I brought you at the end one of my favorite Gemaras, which you've heard from me before, which is the famous Gemara of the farmer that seeks to put the two cows together for the issue of Bechor. Look at number 23. If a farmer decided to put two cows together, two wombs together, and get the animal to get the vlad, get the embryo to come out of one and into the other. Just to remind you, in case you don't know what this is about, that there is a mitzvah of bechor, meaning the firstborn kosher animal, if it's a male, has a special status. Back in the day when we had a mikdash and we had kohanim, it was a big simcha. You gave your bechor to the kohen ate it as a korban, it was a big party, everyone's happy, wonderful, shalom al Yisrael. Today, nobody wants a bechor, because there's nothing you can do with it. There's no mikdash, there's no kohanim. You can't kill it, you can't eat it, you can't work it, you can't shear it. It just runs around wild, like a behemoth, or a vildachaya, maybe even. And it just runs the farm. So every farmer's davening, the first one, please God, let the first one be a girl. Okay? What can you do? Every now and then, the first one is a boy. So comes along a genius Talmudic farmer. and says, you know something? I've solved the problem, partly. I've got a cow, Daisy, who's about to have a baby, which is a male, it's a bechor, there's no way around that. Okay, that will be a bechor. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring Daisy and another cow, Betsy, close together, okay, and I'm going to get the Vlad, the embryo, to come out of one cow, into the other cow, and do a little pirouette inside the second cow, and then come out of the second cow as well. That way, to mix the metaphor, I'll kill two birds with one stone. I'll use one bechor for two cows, and then Betsy, the next time it has a real baby, that will be a second born. Brilliant. Oh, these farmers, they've got a good Yiddish kopf. Mao, says the Gemara, what does it work? Didei patar, it certainly works for Daisy. The lav didei loy patar, but maybe it doesn't work for Betsy, because it's not really Betsy's baby. Or Dilma, the lav didei nami patar, maybe it works for Betsy as well. Teiku, not sure. Is it Gemara? We're not sure. We'll leave it as a question. Tosfos, and I'll leave you with Tosfos. Tosfos gives his all-star list of favorite strange Gemaras. If you ever wanted to read a Tosfos that lists the most interesting Gemaras, and he goes through all of them, the most unlikely cases. And he says here at the end, when he's quoted this one, number 24, Kamad varim ashkechein de loy shchiach. We find many things in the Gemara which are not common. Umari behem hashas, lidrosh lekabeschar. Maybe we have to learn them just to get schar from limud haTorah. Hitzik shnei rachamim v'yatzam izel ezer mahu. Afal pisha lo yavot la'olam. It could never be. It could never happen. Even though Chazal talked about it, it could never happen that you took an embryo from one mother and implanted it in another mother. Can't be. Etavah kazeh. And therefore he says it must be when Chazal talks about that, we just get limud for, schar for limud haTorah, because this source is not relevant. Well, this source is now relevant. We talked about this in our surrogacy discussion. Maybe there are other sources that look on the surface to be less relevant today in the science that we understand. And maybe in 100 years we'll turn around and say, you know something? We thought we were so clever. Maybe we now realize Chazal were deeper and wiser than we ever thought they were. So there are lots of different ways of looking at this. Next week we'll move on to a different topic on the same general science, terror, technology issue. And we'll move on and ahead. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful week.